This is Senator Bob Bennett in Washington with another statewide news conference. We're going around the state to Davis County, to Richfield, and to Logan. So we'll start with Tom Busselberg of the Davis County Clipper. Tom, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. This is probably an issue that hasn't been huge in the news lately, but Utah State Senator Carlene Walker yesterday was talking in a meeting about the identity theft issue and has worked very hard on that issue. She said that she has been meeting with your office and other members of the delegation in Washington, and she referred to your database breach bill.
Right.
I wondered if you could maybe explain that and explain the status. Apparently there's five bills before Congress this year. Just what's happening with that, if you would.
Yes. It has to do with a breach with the credit rating agencies. They have data on your credit report, and if somebody breaks into their database and gets information that could be damaging to you, what do we do about it? What kind of notification? What kind of remediation? All of those kinds of issues. Now, interestingly enough, within the Congress, you said there are five bills going. My bill will make number six. Within the Congress, there are different jurisdictions before different committees. So the Judiciary Committee has a bill. The Commerce Committee has a bill. I'm on the Banking Committee, and that is the one that's looking at my bill. On the House side, it's the same thing. There are three bills. Now, what will happen is that once the Banking Committee bill is reported, Senate leadership will look at the whole issue and decide which bill or which parts of which bills to take to the floor. It's not particularly contentious. My bill is co-sponsored by two Democrats, cross-party lines, very bipartisan kind of effort. And what we're trying to do is create a national standard for the way you handle one of these breaches. In other words, if one of the national credit rating agencies has a problem in its database, how do they respond? How do they notify people who may be at risk? And what level of risk should trigger a response? In other words, if there is a technical breach but that has no risk that anybody's going to get damaged, should everybody be told there was a technical breach? Or should the level of risk say, no harm, no foul? Nobody is at risk here. We've fixed it. This one we don't have to report. Setting that threshold becomes an interesting challenge, and we think we've set it at the proper place at the federal level in my bill. But we will be holding a hearing on that when we come back in September, and it is a very real issue. Carlene Walker's done good work there in the state of Utah, and I've talked to her about it, and we hope we can come up with the right kind of answer on that one. Let's go to Bruce Mayhew in Richfield.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate that. First of all, we'd like to thank you for the being instrumental in the $150,000 you got to the Richfield Airport.
We're always happy to do what we can.
Yeah. City Council has really been working hard on expanding that airport with the growth we're getting here. The question that we had with the Gulf of Mexico Energy Security Bill being passed by the Senate, I believe that just happened recently. Is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, this week.
We were concerned about oil and gas leases, of course, in our area, as well as out in the eastern part of the state, where I believe there was a federal judge that ruled against having the oil and gas companies drilling in that Green River area. And I guess the concern that we have is how much of an effect that they really have on the environmentalists have on stopping the oil and gas leases in case it starts affecting us down here. And the other question is there legislation in place that if there's frivolous lawsuits that come from environmentalists, do they will they end up having to pay for their own court costs, so to speak, instead
yeah.
of just keeping things locked up in court?
Yeah, yeah. you're talking about what the British system calls loser pays.
Right.
Frankly, there will not be any legislation setting in motion a loser pays provision. the American tradition is not the same. There are a lot of people who think it should be, but given the power of the trial lawyers within the Congress, that particular provision is not going to change. Now, what happened is that the court found that the BLM violated NEPA on 20 lease sale parcels by not considering a no-action alternative, and the court reversed the BLM's action and then remanded the whole thing back to the agency for consideration under the court's guidelines. Whether they can, that they being the BLM, whether they can remedy this and issue the leases at some point in the future, or whether this is a final action, I frankly don't know, and I'm not sure that they know. We're taking a good look at the opinion and its impact on oil and gas leases in Utah. We've seen the Legacy Highway. That's one that you don't know that much about in Richfield, but up along the Wasatch Front, lawsuits were brought saying the proper procedures weren't followed. In the end, the procedures were followed. The Legacy Highway is now being built. It's just being built 2 or 3 years late and $200 million of increased costs later. We hope that's not going to be the case here, that it just slows things down and raises costs, but in the end they go ahead. We'll just have to wait and see an analysis of the opinion and what it might mean. All right, Jenny in Logan.
Okay, Senator, I'm wondering what you feel the U.S. role should be in the war that's going on between Israel and the Hezbollah?
That's a very difficult one, naturally, and you have a tradition of raising the difficult questions that we have to address and we have to deal with. There are many views as to what's behind Hezbollah's attack on Israel. One of them is that this is the first time Israel has been attacked not for anything Israel has done, but because Israel is an ally of the United States. And that Israel did nothing to provoke this attack. Hezbollah is assumed to be supplied by Iran. The Iranians put, 12,000 missiles into southern Lebanon at the hands of Hezbollah so that they would be capable of making this kind of attack. And the Israelis are receiving missiles dropped into Israeli territory now at the rate of 100 a day. And their death toll is very, very high as a result of that. Now, there are some who say, well, the United States should tell Israel to stop hitting back. The United States is not going to do that, and frankly, I don't think we would want to do that. What would we do if missiles were being lobbed over the border into Arizona and say, well, let's show restraint in going after the source from which the missiles came? That having been said, there are some things that the Israelis have done that from a tactical military standpoint make some sense, but quite frankly, from a political point of view, have caused them to lose face and lose friends around the world. I think the Secretary of State has conveyed to the Israelis our great concern that they should keep in mind not only the tactical impact of what would be necessary to stop the missiles from coming into Israel, but also the world opinion impact of some of the things they're doing. Some of the bridges that have been bombed, some of the locations that have been bombed. Yeah, you can justify them if your only concern is the military value. But sometimes you say, military value set aside, maybe we shouldn't do this. For example, in the Second World War, the United States did not bomb the Imperial Palace in Tokyo. There were some areas that were simply set off limits. And you can make a tactical case that it might have made sense to do it, but for world opinion purposes, we didn't do it. I think the Israelis are beginning to understand that, and the United States Secretary of State is doing what she can to help them understand that. Beyond that, I think the thing that we should be doing and are doing is trying to marshal a world opinion in the form of a UN resolution to deal with the role of the Iranians. Because Iran is clearly flexing her muscles in the region and making it clear, as best she can to all of her neighbors, that Iran wants to be the dominant power in the region and is willing to do anything to demonstrate that she's the dominant power, willing to attack Israel, willing to offend the United States, willing to set off a conflagration that is causing hundreds, if not thousands, of deaths. The world needs to condemn Iran for that action, and we're doing what we can through World Fora, the United Nations and NATO, European Union conversations, to see that some kind of appropriate condemnation followed by significant sanctions can be put on Iran. Iran could stop this if she wanted to. Iran is responsible for starting it in the first place, and that's ultimately the place where the primary pressure should be put. All right, we're back in Davis County with Tom Busselberg.
Well, thank you. The minimum wage bill has been in the news of late, and it did not pass the Senate. Has been tied to some, apparently been tied to some big changes that could take place with the estate tax. I was wondering, Senator, what your view on this is, if it is a political, huge political maneuver, as some news reports are spinning it, or just what your feelings on the underpinnings of this are.
Well, of course it's a political maneuver. Let's be open and honest about that. The Democrats keep saying to us the most important thing that can happen in the economy is to raise the minimum wage. Now, frankly, I don't think that's right for a variety of reasons. The number of workers who are working at minimum wage level right now is 1%, 2%, something in that very, very low area. And you raise the minimum wage, chances are some of them will lose their jobs, and I'm never sure why they're better off being unemployed at a $7 per hour rate than having a job at a $5.50 per hour rate. But nonetheless, the vast majority, people are already earning above the minimum wage. So raising the minimum wage is a symbolic kind of thing rather than a real boost to the economy. But it's important to the Democrats for whatever reason, and they want to raise the minimum wage. Now, a majority of members of the Senate want to reform the death tax. But the Democrats are making sure that that won't happen because they need 60 votes to shut down a filibuster, and we always get tantalizingly close. We have 55 Republicans. The Democrats will give us an extra 4 votes, so we have 59. Some Republican will drop off and a Democrat will come on because they want to take credit back home for being in favor of reforming the estate tax, but they won't let it happen. So the decision was made, all right, they keep saying the minimum wage is so important, let's tie the two together and see if their enthusiasm for the minimum wage is greater than their opposition to the estate tax. Turned out it wasn't. Turned out we got 58 votes last night. Now, you say, no, the number is smaller than that. That's because Senator Frist changed his vote and voted against the bill, which means under the Senate rules, having voted on the prevailing side, he is entitled to make the motion to reconsider. And he has made the motion to reconsider, and that means we're going to bring it back, and we'll give them another chance in September to tell us if the minimum wage is so important, let a majority of the Senate work its will, because there is a clear and wide majority of senators who want to deal with the estate tax. Let that majority work its will on the estate tax, and if you do, we Republicans, including those of us who think raising the minimum wage is not a good idea, will give you the minimum wage. But sure, it's a political maneuver. we're in a political business, and we're trying to smoke the Democrats out to see just how sincere they are in their insistence that the minimum wage is so important. We're willing to say, all right, since we look at the economy and see that it probably won't make that much difference, all right, we'll give it to you in return for reforming the death tax, as majority of the Senate wants to do, and so far they're saying no. All right, we go to Bruce.
Thanks again, Senator. The Bennett-Matheson land bill in Washington County, just wanted a little update on that. Sometimes we hear some things and then it's dropped off and then we don't hear anything else. But how is that shaping up, since that's the probably the largest area, or one of the largest areas in the states that's really growing?
Yes. Well, I'm encouraged. It's got a tough hurdle, series of hurdles to clear. But frankly, is moving forward, and moving forward fairly nicely. There are a number of groups who have been opposed to any kind of action in this area in the past who are now coming around quietly to us and saying, you know, we think this is probably the best way to solve this. And I say, will you say so publicly? And some of them say, well, maybe. But the most important thing, frankly, is not what they say publicly, but what they say to the members of the committee that will have to vote on it. And if they send the signal to the members of the committee who would otherwise be opposed, look, this is a good thing to do, and we don't want to say so publicly because it might offend some of our constituents, some of our members. But privately, we think Bennett and Matheson have done a good job here. They're beginning to do that. And we expect there will be a formal hearing held in September when we come back. And the committee has then said, we think we can move this bill fairly quickly after the hearing, because as we look at the details, you've lined it up pretty well and solved most of the problems. Now, there are still full-page ads being run. There are groups rallying for protest. One of the interesting things is that whenever these protests and letters to the editor and efforts to stir up public opinion occurs, within our offices, we see how much public opinion it really stirs up. And so far, the answer is none. Aside from the groups that are making a major public effort to try to stir up Utahns to be opposed to this bill, we don't get that many phone calls. Now, maybe I'll stimulate them with this comment on the air, but We don't get that many phone calls, neither does Congressman Matheson. And the few that we do get, we can identify as having come from people who are connected to one of these groups. So I'm getting good response from my Democratic colleagues who are looking at this. The committee staff, both House and Senate, that has looked at it, has said they think it's a good bill. We're getting support and help from Congressman Bishop and Congressman Cannon, who are very, very helpful, and I'm cautiously optimistic we'll be able to get this done. If we don't, then, as you say, Washington County is one of the fastest growing parts of, it is the fastest growing part of the state, one of the fastest growing parts of the nation, and we will not have an orderly process for dealing with many of the challenges. And that's what we're trying to create, an orderly process that will see to it that growth is accommodated and at the same time the conservation values of those lands where we don't want growth to occur can be preserved intelligently. Let me make one last comment about a specific complaint that has been made. Some of the groups that are opposing the bill say, well, you've just given in to the developers, because you are taking land that is currently in a wilderness study area and you're selling it, and you're selling off our heritage to the developers. They should know, and we've told them again and again, the land, we would take 92% of the land that is currently designated as a wilderness study area and make it wilderness. People should understand, it's not wilderness now. It's a wilderness study area, and it's being managed as wilderness, but only Congress can make it wilderness. And we would make 92% of that land wilderness. Well, why not 100? Because we've gone to the land managers, and we've said, How is the best way to manage this wilderness? And the land managers involved have said to us, we can't manage this last 8% as wilderness. It looked good when it was drawn on a map, but when you get down to the realities of managing the land, it doesn't lend itself to being managed as wilderness. And we said, okay, so we take that out of the wilderness designation. They said it will make our job a whole lot easier and, frankly, make the wilderness land safer so that we don't have to waste resources and efforts trying to manage that 8%. We didn't consult with the developers as to what land they wanted. We consulted with the land managers, and we're responding to that. Apologize for the length of the question, but I appreciate your question because it is a very big issue. All right, Jenny?
Is there any chance that an immigration bill will be passed before the session of Congress ends?
You know, I would have said no a month ago, but there are signs that people are moving together a little bit more. The House bill the House members beginning to realize that with their emphasis on securing the border, they have ignored the impact that an intelligent guest worker program would have on helping to make the border more secure. If you have a way to bring in chambermaids and agricultural workers properly documented to work during the season, you make it easier for the Border Patrol to focus on terrorists and drug dealers, criminals, the kinds of people we really want to keep out. So, as the House moves towards saying, well, maybe some kind of guest worker program tied to the securing the border makes sense, the Senate managers are saying, we're willing to talk to you about phasing in some of the things that we want in a comprehensive program and focusing on securing the border first. So conversations towards getting some kind of resolution are beginning to happen. Now, I wouldn't bet a lot of money on our ability to get this done before the election, but I'm encouraged by the signs that I see, and I think there is now a possibility. All right, I'll try to be less long-winded, and let's go through one more round. Tom in Davis County.
Senator, what do you believe, or what are you learning with your intelligence sources as far as what is really happening with Fidel Castro and whether there will be any actual transfer of power, or just what do you see happening there in Cuba?
Frankly, I have no idea. I was with the president the day the announcement was made, and the president indicated there had been no advance warning by any intelligence information that Castro might be ill. So, quite understandably, nobody was prepared for any kind of contingency plan. Now you're getting all kinds of rumors out of Cuba. He's fine. He's going to take power back. He's in a coma. He's really dead. Anywhere in between these rumors, we really don't know. But the assumption is that if Castro is really gone, there will be a fairly significant change. And whether his brother Raul stays as the head or just is an interim until somebody else steps forward, somebody younger, and one hopes easier to deal with, there's a whole question. Are we going to see a wave of immigration out of Cuba? Are we going to see a wave of immigration back to Cuba, out of Florida? Nobody knows. So all I can tell you is stay tuned. I'm watching it with great interest. I think most Americans are. But at the moment, the basic answer to the question is no, I don't have any inside information that I could share with you. Okay, Bruce?
Thanks, Senator. Recently, you were in New Orleans inspecting the levees down there. And I wondered the purpose of the trip, and also does that help for us to kind of work on things here in Utah in case we have any natural disasters and we realize we're not that close to the ocean.
We don't have any levee problems with Great Salt Lake, although we did a few decades ago have flooding problems, and we built the pumps. It's always good to see it on the ground, and I told the folks in New Orleans I was supporting federal funds to help them rebuild, because I supported federal funds to help Utah rebuild after the floods in southern Utah, and I can't be hypocritical and say I want it for my state and not for any other. One of the interesting things that came out of Katrina was the energy bill to which you referred. The Katrina roared through the Gulf and, of course, produced great devastation on land. But one of the things that people noticed was that the offshore drilling rigs that were hit by Katrina did not leak. There were no breaches. There were no leaks of oil and gas into the Gulf of Mexico as a result of the hurricane hitting the offshore drilling rigs. And, frankly, that made it possible for us to pass the bill that we did pass to say there should be more offshore drilling in the Gulf and tap into that enormous reservoir of natural gas that's there. Now, the bill that we wrote provides for state royalties, which means that Louisiana will get money out of the royalties that come from the oil and gas fields that will be developed now as a result of the bill we passed. And one of the things that was clear in my visit to New Orleans was that they have a bigger problem than just repairing the city. They have degradation that has come as a result of hurricanes and other problems out in the Gulf that makes them even more vulnerable. And they can reverse some of that degradation with the money they can get from the royalties that will come from that bill. So it was a very interesting thing to see and understand. And let's hope that something good comes out of it as a result of the bill that we've passed. Jenny, you get the last one.
How do you think Joe Lieberman's primary will turn out next week?
Well, I haven't talked to Joe, but I've talked to a number of senators who have a strong interest in that, and they're predicting that he will lose. Now, the next question is, if he loses the primary and is no longer the Democratic nominee, can he win as an independent? And the polls all say yes. Lieberman is popular enough in Connecticut that if he runs as an independent, he gets reelected. I've had some political consultants up there say no. The Democrats will stay home rather than vote for Lieberman. If he's not the Democrat, they can't stomach the Democrat who will win. They'll stay home. And I say, well, too bad we don't have a really strong Republican candidate. And one said to me, you can replace him. Under Connecticut law, he could withdraw, and the Republican Central Committee could name somebody else. And I said, oh, in other words, we could do a Torricelli? You remember how
I do.
Senator Torricelli withdrew in the last 30 days because it was clear he was losing. And this fellow said, yeah, you could do a Torricelli and have a strong Republican candidate there, and if the Democrats stay home, you could elect a Republican. No, frankly, I don't expect that. I think Lieberman, if he is defeated in the primary, runs as an independent, and I think he wins as an independent. But that's one of the things that makes politics such a fascinating game. You never, ever are sure how it's going to turn out. And there's a very real possibility that we could see everything turn upside down in Connecticut. I frankly think this is a real shame. I like Joe Lieberman. I think he's a very responsible senator. I think he's being attacked because he's a man of conscience and says what he believes. And while I don't believe what he believes on many things, I think of all of the reasons to attack Joe Lieberman, that's the last one you should pick. All right, we've reached the end of the half hour. This is Senator Bob Bennett in Washington, thanking Tom Busselberg, Bruce Mayhew, and Jenny Christensen for another statewide news conference, and we'll see you again next time.